Gordon Fairweather, eldest son of Jack Fairweather and Agnes McKean Fairweather, born on the 27th of March, 1923. My father owned, with others, a sailboat called the Elis, of ancient vintage in my day, and as a matter of fact, the last years of its life, its mast was taken out and we used it as a motorboat. Mostly it was used to go from Rossay Wharf to what we then called the camp on Long Island. Although the Fairweather family didn't ever have an ice boat, as kids, we often were taken on ice boats, usually by Jeff Sayre or either Fred or John Brock. It was, without question, one of the most thrilling sports, but also the coldest possible sport. We often went, continuing this discussion on winter sports, we often went over to the camp on Long Island in winter. In fact, it was a regular habit. You'd go on Saturday, either in skis or snowshoes, put a fire on in the fireplace, light the stove, have an evening meal of sausages and beans, and come back in starlight. This was a great thrill for my brother Jack, who was a year younger, and myself. We were the tag-alongs for the family. The river, of course, had it's a deep river when the kind of the cases, and there were drownings, usually as a result of either canoes or sailing accidents. Sadly, in the upper reaches of the river, people used to come across on trucks heavily laden with pulpwood and would go through, often break through the ice and drown. As far as train travel is concerned, the Rossay Station was a focal point because many people went to the city via the train. The evening train brought the Evening Times Globe, plus, of course, the passengers, and we would go to the station to pick up the paper. Train travel to St. John was cheap, but during the 30s, although it did have a bit of a revival during wartime because of gasoline rationing. I vaguely remember the last of the riverboats coming into Rossay Wharf. I remember them much more clearly on the St. John River itself, where the D.J. Purdy and the Majestic used to come. There are others who you will be interviewing who have better memories of the riverboat travel. However, there was a ferry service operated from Rossay Wharf to the tip of Long Island and then on to Moss Glen by Mark Green. This was just an open boat and it was people used it, they'd come out on the train and then go across either to, as I say, to Long Island or Moss Glen. Swimming was wonderful at the Rossay Wharf. I can remember swimming regattas there. Of course, it would be impossible now, even with a better sewage disposal system. There'd be very little swimming, I would think, at Rossay Wharf. The next item on your little list is houses lost to fire, and I can remember a couple. One, very vaguely, was Canon Daniels. It was a house opposite the Rossay station. remember being told that Canon Daniel overexerted himself and subsequently died of, I presume, a heart attack. But the most spectacular affair in my memory was the Walter Allison house, and my father woke us as boys because of the event, took us down to watch that fire. There is a story told about the fire that a lot of people very busily got together and saved the grand piano. It took 8 or 10 people to move the grand piano out of the house. Meanwhile, they overlooked some very expensive rugs and glassware and other objects there. It seemed to many people that the piano was expendable, but the rugs and paintings perhaps were not, but who can tell. I vaguely remember Kennedy cattle on the Rosse Common, and also remember when the D.D. Robertsons, the Robertson sisters, I believe gave the common, or the common was left to Rosse. This will have to be checked. It was either in a will or but now is a lovely green spot in the middle of the town. And as a matter of fact, the cenotaph, which used to be on the grounds of the consolidated school, now known as the Rosse Park School, was moved to its present location on the common. I, for the Fairweather house, that is the Jack Fairweather house, my father's house, built in the early part of this century by none other than Joseph Henderson, for I believe less than $10,000, was just opposite Jeff Kirsted's blacksmith shop, and this was a source, that is, the blacksmith shop, was a source of great fascination for my brother Jack and me. We would haunt the place, in fact would be sent by Jeff Kirsted up to get the paper at Diggle's store, and would be given a large penny. Not the small penny, but the large penny seemed to us in those days to be worth more than the small and more insignificant penny of today for that chore. We were allowed to work the blower. We smelled the smells. We watched the horses being shod and so on. We were in and out of that blacksmith shop numerous times during our childhood. Activities at the grill. I like the juxtaposition of Jeff Kirsted's blacksmith shop to the next question, activities of the grill when General H.H. McClellan was lieutenant governor. I think the blacksmith shop was probably more important in its time than was the grill, although I don't know. This isn't a snooty statement. I only remember the Grove when H.H. McLean's daughter, Mrs. Stetson, lived there. And we would go to birthday parties for the late Hugh McLean, who would have been a grandson of the lieutenant governor. And he died as a child, I would have thought, before his 10th birthday. And we would go into that house for extraordinary birthday parties, dressed to the nines, in blazers, shirts, ties, and short white flannel pants, and be served cocoa out of, I'm told we were served, I wouldn't have known what the cups were then, out of Crown Derby cups. Anyway, they were very fine children's parties in that house. But I myself have only heard of the festivities for the visit of the prince. Prince of Wales, and so on. I wasn't born in 1920. Recollections of Netherwood. I'll put Netherwood first because Netherwood property adjoined our property, a lovely lilac hedge of my father, that planted by my father, was the only protection Netherwood had from the Fairweather boys. My mother, bless her heart, used to keep an open door policy for Netherwood teachers who needed some relief from the rather restricted regime of Mr. Nong, and the teachers would come, some of them in the mornings, for a cigarette and coffee. I'm sure my mother, by the way, was a graduate of RCS. She herself did not smoke, but in those days, the 30s, she thought that some of Mr. Nong's strictures were too tough on adult people. Anyway, there was an exchange to and fro between through the hedge by teachers. Also, occasionally we would go to the attic of our house where there was a window facing the Netherwood, where Netherwood had their exercises, and would watch Netherwood girls through my father's binoculars. I must say the scene was fairly innocent, as the Netherwood girls were carefully clothed, even in sports, but our imaginations, of course, would run riot. Occasionally we'd share the binoculars with our friends, who somewhat envied our proximity to Netherwood. In truth, like in other things, it turned out rather like Canon's chocolates. The closer you are to the scene, the less attention you pay. Canon's chocolate manufacturers, I'm told, allow their workers to stuff themselves with chocolates for a while, and soon they get on with the business of making chocolate. I went to RCS myself from Form 2A, which would be the equivalent of grade 6. So the first 5 years were at the Rossley Consolidated School. I shared the privilege that many others had of being in grade 1 of that school with a redoubtable teacher called Miss McMurray. I can still remember some of her admonitions, such as if you cough or sneeze or sniff, do it in your handkerchief. If you do not once succeed, try again, and other messages about personal health, and so on. I have very good memories of the Consolidated School and the teachers there, and incidentally, in those days, children from surrounding districts were brought in by, in winter, horse and sleigh, and in summer, horse-drawn, the equivalent of the Orange School bus now. As to RCS, I have good memories, although there was the trauma of Dr. Hibbard leaving. Dr. Hibbard was my godfather, a very dear personal friend of my father's. He and his wife had suffered from the premature death of their son during, I think he was at RMC. And also, Dr. Hibbard, I mean, this affected him, I'm sure. He also was in charge of a private school during the Depression, and had all the anxieties that were entailed in such an operation. I don't know whether you want more on Rossley Collegiate School. Mm-hmm. I was co-head boy with Admiral Daniel Harrington, now Admiral Daniel Harrington, under the aegis of Dr. Bonnycastle, who yes, in my year went off, was called up in the Navy. I went on to the University of New Brunswick for a year before joining the Navy, but he was called up, and others will tell you more about RCS in the Jackson years. We, in those days at RCS, were troubled. Perhaps it sounds now somewhat priggish. I suppose we were prigs. Although RCS was not in light of, you know, Canadian or British terms, an elitist or snobby place. Lots of scholarship kids, sons of clergymen were there on extraordinarily reduced rates and so on. So it was a good cross section. But I mean priggish, we were affected by the events of World War II. I graduated in 1940, and just at the time that France was falling, Paris had fallen, my own father felt deeply upset by in those times, because he and many of his comrades had gone through World War I and knew what was going to happen in Europe. So we decided, Harrington and Fairweather, all of 16, I suppose 17, that it would be inappropriate to have a graduation dance in the middle of the distress of Europe. Our headmaster agreed with that decision, although many of the boys in the graduating class didn't, and I think a couple of them still resent the fact that, we canceled the dance in 1940. That brings me to another recollection of RCS, because how does one, you know, how does one grow up through the 30s with the onslaught of Hitler, the onset of Hitler? And my first real memory of the horrors that were to come came when Hitler went into Austria in 1938. And this was discussed by our class. I suppose I was then in grade 9 or 10. The Anschluss was 1938, I think. And people, of course, teachers and others, wanted us to understand the seriousness of the situation. I remember many good things about RCS. I boarded the last couple of years of my life there, and in the last year shared a room with the late Malcolm Mackay Jr. I have the very best of memories of Dr. Hibbard, one of the great intellects of the Church of England, as it was then called. And I can remember sermons, they were really homilies of Dr. Hibbard's. He would stand in front of at the chancel steps of the RCS chapel, and without a note, deliver in 5, 6, or 7 minutes a little homily at evening chapel on a Sunday. They were unforgettable because of the manner, the informality, and yet the scholarship involved. I remember excellent masters. Jackson, of course, J.F.L. Jackson, Legasic, Coster later became became a senior clergyman in, I think, Fredericton. And Mr. Cox, George Wally, who left the school to take up a Rhodes Scholarship, I think, and then went into the Navy, that later became professor of English at Queen's University. He ran the scout camp at RCS, and we, under his leadership, held meetings outdoors from the organizing of the scout troop in September or October until the following May. No matter, despite the weather, we held, we for an entire school year held all our scout meetings outdoors. No church basements for George Wally. Your little list of questions moves on to recollections of Depression days. I have to confess that Depression wasn't obvious to me except people who would come seeking meals. And the rule in our, it was more than a rule, I think I want to say this about my parents, it was an ethic that no person coming to our house would ever return, seeking food would ever be turned away. So food was prepared, and people would come up what's now called the Tennis Court Road from the railway tracks and go along, I think the operative word is begging, but seeking food. They would come off the trains, freight trains. And so I realize from those early childhood memories, I now know, of course, that even though my father was a busy lawyer, times were indeed tough. He was the MLA for Kings County from 1930 to 1935, before the days of unemployment insurance, before the days of old age security. And it wasn't a matter of partisan politics, but his note to the road supervisor would mean food or no food for people, because the note meant, could you find a few days' work on the road for this or that person. These wouldn't be, of course, RASE people, mostly, although there were some RASE people who found the Depression very tough.
What was a road supervisor?
Well, they were rather like a foreman. I think in these days of seal-coated roads, they're still supervisors. They are, I can't think of a better word than foreman. And each district would have his roads, have its road supervisor. And the MLA, many people think that this was patronage. Well, it was, in the purest sense of the word, patronage, but I can assure you that in my father's case, and I tried to follow this example, it was providing work on the road so that people could eat or get supplies for school. Incidentally, this reminds me of the cruelty of children, but we had the son, I think, of either the Baptist or United Church minister in RASE. In my school, at RASE Consolidated School days, who had to tell the teacher that he could not, his family were unable to afford a new scribbler, you know, 10 cents or a quarter, whatever the teacher wanted. I suppose many of us made fun of that child in those days, and I'm rather ashamed of that fact. But obviously there were people that were hurting, and there were people who came to school with not enough to eat. This is school, this is the Consolidated School. Incidentally, the word I was seeking earlier when I was discussing the school, my method of transport was a school van. and in the summer the flaps of the van, it was a black kind of canvassy top, and they would be rolled up, the kids hanging out the sides. In the winter, it must have been pretty cold, there would be straw on the floor of the vans, and they'd come from all the way out of Gondola Point through Quispamsis and so on, bringing children to that school. My father once told me that he was on the school board. I think the school built that school in 1914, and many people in those days criticized the school board for its extravagance building that school out of brick. My father wasn't alive, but of course the school was, that very building won an award from architectural and heritage people when it was revamped or given, being bad on words this morning, but in the 70s I think it was rebuilt, and teachers love it because it had high ceilings and lots of light, nice big windows, and won an award. And my father said after the Second World War, when people were complaining about other schools being built and the extravagance, and he reminded me that nothing had changed. And he teasingly said that he joined up in 1915 or so, whenever he did go to the First World War, to get off the Rossley School Board. That was obviously a joke, but he was interested in the fact that the complaints were just the same 30 years later, and presumably are the same 60 years later, and will be on in time. Dr. Peters was our family doctor. With, I can remember his, the gold watch. He did, of course, house calls. My brother Jack had pleurisy, I think. Incidentally, an other brother died as a child, not in Rossley, but on the train, being taken by my mother. I was with my mother. I was four. The child, of course, would have lived now. It had a thyroid problem that was easily treatable in the 1980s and 90s. But Dr. Peters did make house calls. It was my mother, found, I mean, the silly expression, the master bedroom, the bed, the room in which my mother and father slept had a fireplace and was a nice big old-fashioned bed, so that the patient, either Gordon, Jack, or David Fairweather, would be moved into that bed during the day, as being a larger room and more space in the bed, bigger in which to have puzzles and other things. And I can remember Dr. Peters coming in and looking at children. I now learn that he was a very blunt and direct man. But this, of course, was not, I didn't understand this as a child. My brother David went to him after the war. He was an old man, to have a medical for a life insurance policy, and Dr. Peters bluntly said to him, go piss in the basin. Perfectly straightforward, direct, country doctor talk, but to a somewhat fastidious younger brother, this seemed inappropriate. I don't think it was inappropriate, and think Dr. Peters was just telling a young man to go do what he thought a young man would know how to do. Another story about, I'm not sure whether Dr. Peters did this, but at RCS, and this is my brother Jack's time at ICS, not mine, but I know the story and it's worth telling. Sex education was never given to me at ICS. There were rather complicated allusions made to it during confirmation classes. But during my brother Jack's day, a clergyman would give sex instruction. A bachelor clergyman called Francis Keeble, a delightful man, but quite an inappropriate person to give lively boys sex education. And my brother went to my father and said that Mr. Keeble has us totally mixed up about sex. Would you get the Board of Governors to arrange for a doctor to give us some instructions? Now, that's the way the story is told in the 70s and 80s. I don't for one minute believe my brother. I think he probably made the representations to our father, but not quite as bluntly as I'm putting it now. Anyway, a doctor did the terrible deed, and from that time on. I, of course, because a first aide was owned by my uncle Percy, who inherited it from my grandfather, A.C. Fowler, we knew a lot about the farm. My uncle was a conservationist and an environmentalist long before those terms had been invented. And he spent a lot of time and energy on reforesting land, on seeing that the brook flow, the water flow was, that the water was able to flow off properly. And we would walk up the brook to clear it of logs and other, I was going to say flotsam and jetsam, but that's a sea term. Anything that inhibited the flow of water. Now, this would be a great adventure in summer in the brook. My uncle Percy kept Jersey cows. Our house was supplied by milk from it for years. Also, farm produce. The farm person, the farm manager, if that isn't too fancy a term, or farm hand, if manager is too fancy, was Harmon Meyer, and we dearly liked him, liked to go. He seemed to like children, and we spent a fair amount of our childhood in and around the barn at Fershed. Camps and cabins. We had a camp, as I say, on Long Island. As I remember it, but my cousin Margaret Bourne would know this for sure, it was jointly owned by Mr. H.W. Frink, my father, Dr. Hibbard. Others had shares at other times. It was really a place to come and go to. I myself didn't spend very many nights there because my own mother, sister, from 1929 on, had the place in which this interview is taking place at Holderville in the Kingston Peninsula. So my childhood days were spent here at Long Reach and not at the camp on Long Island, although my two sisters, Hammond and Barbara, had many camping expeditions to Long Island. The old Dodge car, jointly owned by my Uncle Percy and my father, seems to me to exemplify the brotherly affection the two had one for the other. My grandfather was a lawyer but also had an insurance business, and upon his death my uncle Percy Fairweather carried on the insurance business, A.C. Fairweather and Sons Limited, and my father was a lawyer, trained at Harvard, an undergraduate at the University of New Brunswick. My father was very athletic, rowed at Harvard, played cricket, played rugby, football at the University of New Brunswick and also at Harvard. Many people, of course, from the Maritimes went to the Harvard Law School in those days. It was overnight, I think overnight by boat or the Boston train or so on, rather than make the long journey from St. John to Toronto or somehow Dalhousie, and the excellence of Dalhousie Law School was lost on St. John's. Probably that was part of the ancient rivalry of Halifax and St. John. Anyway, my father went to Harvard. I am the first son of his second marriage. His first wife died somewhere in 1907 or 8, I would have thought. My mother was Agnes Charlotte McKean. Her father was a medical doctor in, as they called it, Glasgow, now called Glacebury, Nova Scotia. And they came, she and her sisters and brother, to Rossay to be close to an aunt, Mrs. Blair, because of the death of my mother's parents. My mother, my grandmother first, and then my grandfather in his 50s. And the family moved, as I say, to Rossay. My mother was a gentle person, but had convictions, and she was, I suspect, a Presbyterian. But came to St. Paul's Church, Rossay, with my father, and certainly her adult life was as an Anglican. But she would not go, she did not like Good Friday services in St. Paul's Church. By the way, they were the long 3-hour service. Many a time as children we went through those services, because in the church porch in those days, rather than have a collection on Good Friday, there was a plate there, and there was a little notice saying gifts for the money would be used for the conversion of the Jews. That comes out of the very ancient and narrow-minded, I mean, that kind of proselytizing and blaming Jews for the death of Jesus, I believe. I don't know whether my mother thought through that, but she understood and disliked that message. And I honor her memory. I honor her for that fact. We were a household where social issues were discussed. My sisters, Barbara and Hanlon, of course, were older. We were talking about the Depression. I guess I realize now that because there were often so many members of my mother's, usually my mother's family, staying with us, that was partly due to the Depression. But also there were large extended families on both sides, and comings and goings, so the table was always had lots of people. My father became a judge in 1935. I think that others would say this, so it won't seem too much of a boast. he was an ideal, both intellectually and temperamentally, for a judicial appointment. And he was in the trial division, had many serious criminal trials, including a couple of several murder trials. We, once again, I'm afraid there was a bit of teasing going on, because my father had three unmarried sisters. Muriel used to teach Sunday school, and in an extraordinary bit of irony, at least one of Muriel's Sunday school pupils became the accused in a murder trial in another in Moncton or in Dorchester, and my father had to sentence him to that. That wouldn't have been understood by us, I think, us meaning my brothers and me, but it was by a couple of other older members of our family, and they used to say that Mr. Bannister, the Bannister boys, were taught by my aunt and hanged by my father. Another example of a rather insensitive comment by Leone. I can remember, and perhaps others will note this, because we have a large extended family, the mayor was very important. The mayor is not as important to some now, but my mother's aunts and her sisters wrote, and my mother wrote back to them. They were interesting letters, and the mail was an important part of family communications in those days. I wouldn't have thought of, I think it wasn't until wartime. Presumably my parents used the long-distance telephone, but the mail was the source of information, and many letters from my mother's sister, Alice Colfers, Alice McKean Colfers, who spent the war, who returned, went to England with her husband, who was a clergyman. And those letters could be published, I'm sure, as comments of the wife of a country clergyman in wartime England. Incidentally, my parents took for the war my mother's niece, Dorothea Colthers, who was a child, came as I suppose 10 or 11, and spent the war years with my parents. Just another couple of comments about Rasa and people. There were some very interesting people. Dr. Hibbard, who was headmaster of Rasa Collegiate School, I've mentioned his intellectual capacity. But another of his friends, Walter Miles, the Miles name is now only on a little side road in Rasa, but both the sisters, both the daughters and son of Walter and Nora Miles have died. But Walter Miles, tea taster, as he's called, I think he was part of the T.H. Estabrooks company, certainly subscribed to English papers, and he and Dr. Hibbard and Rupert Turnbull, W.R. Turnbull, the inventor, were friends of my father's, played bridge with him, sailed with him, hunted partridge with him. I don't think perhaps Mr. Miles did, but there was a, it wasn't a country village without any sort of intellectual pretensions. Pretension isn't the right word. There were highly educated people who were part of my growing up. And I, although it was a small village, in truth a suburb of St. John, and had the Jeff Kirsteds and the others who were part of it, and Norman Diggle, the storekeeper, who incidentally many others may have described him to you, but we used to be astounded because his hair and his eyebrows and his mustache were all different colors. Red, white, and black is my memory of them. Or perhaps white hair and reddish eyebrows, or, you know, the reverse. No, obviously the eyebrows would be black, but the mustache and the hair were of different colors. And the Diggle people, it was the Bills. Do you want me to go on with Diggle stuff? Well, you see, they'd be done every item because you'd charge things. The bill would come once a month, all in extraordinarily beautiful handwriting. You know, one soda pop, 0.05 cents. Yeah, well, the Diggle store, the bills would come, it wasn't quite calligraphy, but it was next best thing, covering, in our case, we were a large family, and several pages. I am told now that there were some of the Rosse so-called swells who, in the case of Diggle's and Merritt's, the other grocery store across the road, and Kennedy's, owed them a lot of money for a very long time. I mean, that I wouldn't know as a child. Incidentally, my parents were not gossips. I've now learned how precious this is. And my father's ethic was, if you can't say anything, yeah. And it wasn't part of my childhood. But I've learned since that there were people who used the suppliers, and they just abused, not used, they abused them. Anyway, the bills would come, and the delivery system. Have people talk to you about the deliveries? Mm-hmm. Well, you see, there was the fish man. And then later, when Frischett stopped supplying milk, the milkman, and the vegetable man, the egg man, plus the corner store. And in early days, you would take bottles and things to get vinegar and molasses and other things in bulk. I mean, we're returning now to that kind of thing, but in Diggle's, there'd be a great display counter of various cookies.
Now, I have some questions.
Yeah, I want to finish the cookies.
Oh, sorry.
Because my mother would order cookies from Rankin's Biscuits, and the biscuits, the cookies would be sent, a box would be sent to my father's office. This was the way that a lot of stuff came from St. John. Laundry, you'd take to St. Joseph's. Laundry, where wayward girls, as they were known as, usually single mothers, would work God knows what wages, but they did a wonderful job on laundry, run by sisters in Waterloo and St. John. But anyway, that my mother would, we would make up, we would stand at her elbow as she called St. John to Rankin's Biscuits. They would take the order and make up a tin box, and it would be delivered to 42 Princess Street, or my father would pick it up on the way home. And Humphrey's Coffee was another thing. They wouldn't deliver, but you'd go, it was at the foot of King Street. And I smell the smell since, but never as evocatively as going into Humphrey's. Sorry, you weren't.
That's okay. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I want to get something straight, but now how many stores were there? Like, there was a grocery, Diggle's was mostly grocery.
Yeah.
Now, Merritt's.
Merritt's had the post office and grocery.
Now, who owned the Merritt? Is that
Merritt was Lou Merritt.
I see.
And I think his either his brother or cousin was part of it. There are older people on your list of interviewees that will know more about that. I just knew it was Merritt's store, and Lou Merritt lived where the chiropractor was. The chiropractor now lives. Or lived in half that house.
Okay. Thank you. I'm interested in
that. You did mention the politics. As I say, my father was in politics. I'm told now, because I followed, not followed directly, but was a member of the Legislative Assembly from 1952 to 1962, and MP from 1962 to 1977, when I resigned to become Chief Commissioner of the Canadian Human Rights Commission. And I resigned back to become Chairman of the Immigration and Refugee Board in 1987. But it wasn't an easy time for anybody to be in politics in the 30s. Although my father felt the defeat, he was defeated by the son of a very good friend, Walter Foster. And I think in this interview you should try to see Mrs. McCready, who people will know about her. She was a sister of a daughter of the late Senator Foster, but the brother of the late Walter Foster, who beat my dad, I think, by 50 or 60 votes in 1935. In those days, there were slates of candidates, and one of the, and this is an anecdote that just enlivens what must be rather dull conversation. One of the people who beat my father and was with Walter Foster on the ticket, as it was called, was a chap called Colin MacDonald, who subsequently went bankrupt. My father, as a judge of the Supreme Court Trial Division, MacDonald, after he left politics, or was defeated actually, was his lawyer sought to discharge him as a bankrupt. And it is said that the lawyer was prepared with a long plea, and the accountants were ready with it all there. My father said, "That won't be necessary, Mr. Barry, MacDonald's lawyer. Mr. MacDonald did me a mighty favor in 1935, and I'm prepared to return it now." He discharged his bankrupt without a long
procedure.
He would have read the pleadings, of course. We had what we called the Tilly Club in our backyard. Because of my father's interest in politics, that we kids had an interest too. And we got some. Tilly was a rather ineffectual premier, I think, but he succeeded C.D. Richards, who became Chief Justice. And perhaps this will help fill out some of the scene for you. Tilly lived in Rossay, as did my father, L.P.D. Tilly. And they were appointed to the bench at the same time, but my father to the Supreme Court of New Brunswick and Tilly to the county court. It was said that Mrs. Tilly said, "Oh, there must have been some mistake. Tilly had been premier." And it was said there was no mistake at all in terms of legal skill. This may sound boastful, but it's long ago. There was no doubt that my father was a better lawyer. But Tilly was carried on as a judge. But it's said, by the way, that the white line in the pavement, this is another anecdote, and these stories
are good to have.
They are stories, and sure, historians will turn up their noses at them. But the joke is that they painted the white line in the highway. The first pavement was from St. John to Rosse, and they paved the white line, or painted the white line in the road to show Mrs. Tilly the way home. That was the joke of the day, ha ha. But it's as good as many
jokes.
Yeah,
that's nice, that's what we're after. I'm curious about politics. Where would the local people in Rosse vote? How would they vote?
They voted in the consolidated school.
And what type of votes, the procedures, are they very same?
The same as anywhere else. They'd be the poll, you know, and...
Put the miles on Grove Avenue?
Well, the miles on Grove Avenue was late. Barbara and Sally Miles built the house in which Mrs. Hugh H. Mackay lives. She bought it when Miss Barbara Miles died 2 or 3 years ago. But they lived in what, to older residents of Rosse, would have been the Moffat Bell House. That is directly across the road from Chatillon. That's where they live. You wanted... I'm not sure. I suppose there are lots of characters. Miss Dorothy Purdy and her father. Mr. Ellis would know, Mrs. Ellis would know of her, and Mrs. Hunter, Dorothy Purdy. Look, you have a long list. There were a lot of characters. I think in those days, eccentricities were overlooked, perhaps a little more than they are today. Or perhaps in this age of the so-called nuclear family, one doesn't come across them as often. Or perhaps we ourselves, I mean my generation, are themselves the...
More relaxed.
They're more relaxed. Or perhaps we, to your generation, are the characters.
Significant happenings to Rosse now. I'm sure we haven't covered all of them. The railroad station obviously is not the biggest, I would say, it made Rosse. Rosse was summer cottages. But what were other things that happened that either sent Rosse into a turmoil, or made it grow, or caused it to change?
Well, the change from village to town occurred in the 50s. Frankly, it was based on the amount of grants. The province gave more grants to a town, and there were the first effort Rosse had, I think the census was taken when the schools were out, Netherwood and RCS. Well, I don't mean by this that they counted the border, the school borders, but certainly teachers and all that. Anyway, Rosse met, I think the magic number was 1,000. This you may want to check. I mean, as to where, if it's important. Yeah, but it was a number game. And some people, in fact, my order in council appointing me to one of my offices, not the present one, because I'm considered now of Ottawa, but is of the village of Rosse, which had ceased to exist by the time my appointment. But presumably they looked up some old document about me, found that I had born of the village of Rosse. But there was Mrs. Ethel Steele. The Steele boys will be able to tell you about their mother, who kept the books. She was an extraordinarily courageous woman. She was widowed early in her life. In fact, I would have thought this was the first or second, or perhaps third of my recollections of death. The first one was when Margaret Bourne's sister Martha died. And I was in grade one. She died, I think, of complications of scarlet fever. And I suppose she would have been 10 or 11. And Mrs. Hunter, generation, I think. Not that I'm so far off from really the same generation, but my family would keep calling my uncle, and one day my father or mother called to find out about Martha. And Martha had died during the night, and they came back to say Martha has died. Well, to that child, death, that was meaningless. I used to be asked all the time at school about Martha because she was a beloved little girl, and the town was concerned. And I said to the teacher, "Martha's dead," when she asked me. Well, of course, to the teacher, this was terribly distressing, and I suddenly realized something serious. I can't remember funerals or anything. I mean, her funeral. I do remember the day that H.H. McLean, about whom you asked. I mean, I remember the court. Cortege. And I remember when I think it was Jack Hibbard, Canon Hibbard's son's body came back on the train, and the RCS boys went down to the station in uniform. What I remember was the drumbeat and also the very great distress in my own house about. And I thought since that, although I know my parents were trying to protect us, perhaps it would have been better to have a little more of an explanation. My parents found emotion hard to cope with. And although they were very, very loving, outward demonstrations were in that day and age. Yeah.
Tell me, you said that all the RCS boys in uniform made you think. I don't have a really good description of what the uniform was like. The colors, the hockey team colors, I know was red and white.
No, blue and white.
Blue and white. Oh.
Blue and white are the school colors. But the uniform was an Oxford gray, which is perhaps a little lighter than your, that's black, I guess. What we're talking about is your machine there. An Oxford gray is a very, dark gray. The material, I thought, you usually bought the uniform in either Manchester MRAs or Oak, Scoville Brothers, Oak Hall, wasn't it called? You wouldn't know, it's gone long since. And it buttoned right up to the collar, and when you were on parade, you wore a shirt and tie under the tunic, and only on parade was the tunic buttoned, the top button, and then there were hooks at the collar, and there was a brocade on the arm, and the regular corporal sergeant and things, and then if you were an officer in the cadet corps, you had epaulet and the symbol on your shoulder. A very tough material, and a lot of that, which was the point of it all, and I mean, not for cruelty, but because of abuse of boys in hard. And then you could, in spring, there was a flannels and blazer, I presume still the rig.
RCS. What? Now, you said you could buy the uniforms from the Scoville, you said.
Scoville Brothers was a men and boys clothing store in St. John, and MRA was a department store. They would, I mean, they would, RCS, well, you'd go and be measured to some, or they'd have the various boys' sizes.
What type of activities, athletic-wise, would go on? And what type of subjects would you take? And were you involved in music?
Oh, I was involved in, to answer the last first, I played a cornet or a trumpet in the school band. That was all. I wasn't, although there was music in our house, and piano, and my family, they, in those days, didn't have many records. A few. Nowadays, you know, any of those extras in the 30s were, and that's where people were careful. And I sang in the boys' choir at RCS and at the church in Rossay as a, you know, a treble, as it was called. And I, George Wally, I referred to him earlier, taught music, and we also went as a choir and sang on the radio, CHSJ. But the subjects were the Nova Scotia matriculation, which was considered a better matric in those days than New Brunswick. I don't know whether it was or wasn't, but that was the matric. You took your, you know, the regular.
English, Latin.
Yeah, I took Latin right through, and I'm very glad I did, and then went on and took it for a year at university.
Well, Latin gives a lot of English.
Yeah,
roots.
Yeah.
Anything out of the ordinary by Latin except for Latin? I know some people took French.
Oh, yeah, we took French at RCS, yeah.
I don't know.
Not exceptionally well taught. Bonnycastle himself took French, taught French.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say part of it was motivation. I don't, but we would look at school, at university curriculum. After all, most of us would be going on, and you would learn what you needed to go to university and tailor your courses.
So, when you say that was there like a set curriculum?
Oh yeah, it was the Nova Scotia matriculation. And I would have thought there could have been a slight shift, say, between trigonometry and chemistry in advance, something like that. But otherwise, it was a set curriculum. And in fact, if a boarding school doesn't teach better than anywhere else, you know, what's the point? Other than the fact that in many places in New Brunswick in those days, there were no opportunities for high school.